You're listening to Good Sentences, the podcast that's guaranteed to tickle your literary ear holes and make you wish you'd listened to dear old mom when she said to put down those lawn darts and learn how to read. And now, here are your hosts, neither of whom listened to dear old mom. This is Craig A. Hart and S.J. Varengo.
Welcome back to the Good Sentences podcast with Craig and Scott.
We're here live, although not when you hear us, but right. It's all live now, so anything can still happen and probably will. I've done everything I can to eliminate all the distractions. I took the dog out. I ate lunch so the mic didn't pick up my tummy sounds. So I think I'm ready, Craig.
As ready as I'll ever be. And I didn't even have all that stuff to do. I did put the kids down for a nap. So there is a possibility because they're not asleep yet. So if they start throwing a tantrum, I'll just turn my mic down and ignore them. So they'll be fine. They'll be fine. They're 5 years old. I'm pretty sure they're capable of meeting their own basic needs.
Yes, and they're still at that age where their bones are fairly flexible.
Yeah, you know, so how much can go? It'll be fun. Right. Now, speaking of basic needs, we're going to be talking about characterization today, or at least one aspect of it. Part of the basis for what we'll be talking about is Maslow's hierarchy of needs. It basically lays out a really good starting point for figuring out your character's motivations within the story you are creating. The hierarchy of needs, as you would assume, it's a pyramid graph. Starts with basic needs like food, water, warmth, security, safety. And once those are taken care of, then the human can then begin to worry about other things like psychological needs, like relationships, friends. And then finally, once we get all that taken care of, then you move up to self-actualization, achieving your full potential. So for example, you know, we in the United States have basically, for the most part, we have our problems. We've basically taken care of most of these needs.
Right.
Which leaves us with, I don't feel fulfilled, you know, whereas somebody in a third world country is like, what the hell are you talking about? I'm wearing pop bottles for shoes.
Yeah, right? I just got my lunch out of a dumpster. Right,
exactly. In which I think a lot of, in the U.S., leads to that generational divide, too, because like our grandparents, for example, mm-hmm. or you know, people who went through the Great Depression, they look at, say, millennials, for example, and they're like, what the hell is going on with you people?
For sure, sure. In my case, it was my dad was a Depression survivor, and I heard it every goddamn day. You don't know how lucky you've got it.
An event like the Great Depression in people's lives was so traumatic, as you were mentioning, they never got over it.
Absolutely like, not.
Kim's grandparents, for example, they still save everything. Like, you never know. Like, it could happen again, and then we'll be prepared. Yep. Especially since a lot of them, like her grandparents, when they went through, they were kids. And so, you know how, you know, children, their environment
it's
like
burned into their,
it's hardwired into their heads and they can't get away from it. It's almost like a PTSD.
Until the day he died, my dad used to save old bread bags.
Yes.
In case he ever got holes in his shoes or anything.
Yep.
Now, at this point, he's fucking living in Florida.
Yeah.
So aside from like, you know, monsoons, I don't think his feet are going to get too wet, but he, to the day he died, made my mother save every bread bag that they emptied.
Yep. And rubber bands and twist ties.
Oh yeah.
Those are other things, which rubber bands, of course, that was also World War II when you know, every scrap of rubber was being used for the war effort, but good time. So the point is that you are well served to examine your characters in your story and figure out which of these needs they are dealing with, because the basic of every, and today I would be talking mostly about motivation in character, and so pretty much every motivation is driven by dissatisfaction in some way. Now, some examples of motivation: survival could be a life or death, but not always. Survival can be as simple as maybe surviving within your social circle. A great motivation is for characters to do what they are doing because they have to in order to stay alive. And I'm thinking of any dystopian, I guess the relatively recent zombie craze is a great example of that. People do absurd things that they wouldn't normally do but we accept it as a reader because they're doing it for survival, and you can excuse just right. about anything
right.
If it comes down to basic survival.
Yeah, my my current read is Margaret Atwood's The Handmaid's Tale. There's a whole group of people who are doing literally what they need to do to survive. And at the same time, with the main character, as the novel advances, her motivation is also to take down this regime. And so the motivation does change, but it certainly starts out with 100% survival mode. You know, they're stringing women up yep. left and right for looking the wrong way.
And that's a good point you bring up, because motivations can evolve and change throughout yep. a book in response to events in the story. So it can start out as one thing, but it can easily become another. The only key there is there needs to be a motivation for that change as well.
Exactly. Yep. If I can just jump in, I think this is another place, going back to some of the stuff we talked about in our last show, where the reader might not at first even notice that the motivation is changing. This might be another area where you, the author, have that godlike knowledge of what's going on mm-hmm. that the reader doesn't go into with. And the motivation can be apparent, as it is in, you know, the zombie examples that you pointed out, and as it is with Handmaid's Tale. But again, that subtle shift might be the thing that takes you from a good story to a great book.
A lot of beginning writers have a tendency to show their hand too quickly, so yeah. to speak. So there's nothing wrong with allowing your backstory to develop. In fact, mm-hmm. that is advisable. You don't have to explain everything up front. You don't have to lay it all out. And as you said, the reader doesn't necessarily need to know all the motivations and everything right away. Readers will follow you as long as they feel like you are leading them somewhere.
Right.
And as long as you don't do something overt to jerk them out of the story, there's got to be something leading them on. But the readers can be pretty patient. If you're telling a good story, they'll stick with you. I mean, they'll assume that at the end you'll tie it all together. And if you don't, that's a problem.
That's so, probably the last book of yours they're going to read.
Right, exactly. Like it's the yeah. old Chekhov's gun kind of thing. If you show the gun on the mantelpiece, mm-hmm. by the end of the play or the story, the gun had better have gone off. I'm always taken back to the college class I was in, and a creative writing class, and I had written a story for it, and pretty pleased with it, turned it in, and the professor said, good story, but the ending, you didn't earn it. Mm-hmm. The ending was good. The ending by itself was a good ending, but you didn't earn it. And what she meant was I hadn't let the backstory develop. I had gone from telling the beginning of the story straight to the end. Like there wasn't a sufficient
right.
middle to warrant such a dramatic ending. It was like, what? It came off where if I'd built it up, it could have been, you know, very dramatic and all, but it just came off as cheesy because you're like, okay, whatever. What? What's happening? Like
right.
the character had no sufficient motivation to do what they did. Even though what they did was interesting, it didn't work because I had not put in the work to earn that ending.
I'm picturing how that could have gone in my head, and I'm just seeing you spending the first like few pages describing his lunch, and then on the final page you're like, and then he became president
yes,
of the United
right.
States of America.
Right. He murdered everybody in town at the end.
And then he became president.
Right, exactly. You can have the best ending in the world, but if you don't build up to it properly, nobody's going to care. So motivations can evolve or change in response in the story. And I think another important thing is that having two or more competing motivations, sometimes within the same character, can be an instant source of conflict or another major driving force in a story. For example, you have somebody who can have two different motivations. They can be motivated by, let's say, for example, their revenge, but they can also be motivated by love. And perhaps that love in their life is trying to pull them away from the revenge because
right.
they see no good's going to come of it. And so they've got to decide between, is my desire for revenge or my love for this person, you know, which one of those is greater? And so those, if you have two different motivations, it's a lot more complicated to balance, but it can add, again, conflict, more depth to the story.
That's the key word right there is depth, because to me, a conflicted character is immediately a deeper character than an unconflicted character. You know,
right.
there's certainly a million great unconflicted characters in the history of literature. And I don't mean to say that every character you write has to be conflicted. But when I'm reading a book and I come across that person who has two motivations essentially at war within him or her, I'm sold.
When it comes to motivation, there are other examples, too, that I scribbled down before the show. So we talked about survival, revenge, love, hate, and duty. And duty. If you listen to the other show, and you'll realize why we're chuckling. I think it's in there. I don't know if I may have edited that out in an attempt to make us appear as if we were 12-year-olds. I don't know.
This will probably end up on the cutting room floor, too, but I'm going to keep doing it.
But if you... You know, if you can use more than one of those. So going back to one motivation with duty is I heard the chuckle.
At least I don't do it in my Beavis voice anymore.
I'm even trying to pronounce the T.
It doesn't matter.
We all know what you meant.
Try again. This time I'll cover my mouth. Go ahead.
I don't know if I can.
I don't know if I can do it. You better say it fast.
Is there another word for it? Responsibility? Obligation? There we go.
Obligation. Now I know what you're using it for. Right, so that, exactly. That's just funny.
It's a euphemism for poop. I actually forgot what the point I was trying to make anyway.
Something about duty. That was probably like your crowning point of the whole discussion, too. And I'm sure it was.
Trying to figure out.
Oh, well.
Any sort of segue to get back to the. Let's see.
Speaking of two idiots doing a podcast, that reminds me. How's that for a segue? And now for something completely different.
But if you can sufficiently introduce a motivation for your characters, whether it's a single motivation, dual motivation, or conflicting motivations, that will absolutely add a lot of depth and character to your story. And it will not only provide a better hook for the reader, but by the end, it'll be one of those stories where they'll walk away remembering it instead of walking away, all right, what's next? And certainly, I think that a reader can often, if it's, well, careful how I say this, because part of this I don't even actually, now that I started saying it, I don't actually agree with it myself. You know,
that
there are sometimes, and I've started saying something.
Of an honest man, yep, right there.
Sometimes
I'm going to make this point, but it's bullshit. So.
It's like, I guess what I was going to say is that it's often seems easier, or the reader can pick up on when the writer is having a good time. I mean, on the other hand, the reason why I don't totally agree with it is that there are plenty of times I know as a writer when I have had to force myself to approach the keyboard.
And that, like, doesn't necessarily mean that what you produce isn't great.
Yeah. I mean,
it just means it felt a little more like work that day.
Yeah. I mean, there have been times when some of the hardest writing days have turned out some of the best stuff.
And I'm glad that we've decided to really kick off the show with working on character in depth, because all that other stuff is absolutely essential. You know, you need a good setting, you need all that. But when it comes right down to it, don't you think that as human beings, the thing we're going to relate to most is human beings?
Absolutely. No question about it. It doesn't really even matter what the art form is.
Right.
You know, we're talking about writing because that's what this podcast is about. But the human experience is the foundation of art. And that's why little videos on YouTube go viral. For example, most of them have to do with some nice little story, you know, like, oh, you know, tears. And it usually has something to do with some human experience. Right. And so if you can tap, and this was, I feel somewhat qualified to talk about this, not because I'm an expert at it, but because I was so bad at it.
Right. Yeah. No, I get you.
And like, my characters were terrible. I was of the mind that the plot was the thing.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, action, action, action. Things have to happen now, now, now. And there's certainly nothing wrong with fast-paced plots, like the Spyco novellas are known for that. But if the character in your story, if nobody cares about the character, then they don't care about the events. Plot is not the thing, but it's who is it happening to. That's the important thing.
Right. Yep. I agree completely. I'm thinking as you're talking, going back to the Spyco novellas, the James Burke that appears in Assignment Athens as compared to the James Burke that appears in Assignment London. Because when I think of Assignment Athens, and when I first read that, prior to us even discussing writing more and working together and so on, the thing that stuck in my mind through the whole book was James Bond. James Bond in the Ian Fleming novels is an incredibly deep character.
Right.
In the movies, he's a guy who bangs hot chicks and shoots people. Right. And I think that's a good way to characterize, you know, the early characters in that series as compared to, you know, where they are now, where basically we know a lot about all of them. And if I had never been involved in the project at all, I would still love it because those characters have become really deep people as we've gone on, you know?
Mm. You're so right about the James Bond difference between the books and the movies. I remember the first James Bond book I read was one of those that had I cried at the end. And you wouldn't think that to be the case. And if you were, if you just knew it watching for the movies, you're like, what?
Yeah. Oh, Fleming was a masterful storyteller.
Yeah. The thing it that, yeah, the incredible. Tragedy. And that's earning that the particular plot event I'm thinking of was an example of he earned it. Like he went through, like he got married, you know, and so he took us through this whole thing. And you could really feel Bond's joy and his happiness. And then, well, you know, probably know, you've probably read it, you know what happened. So, but yeah, it was just one of those, just a punch in the gut. And you would never get that from the movies.
Yep.
So read the books.
Never. No. I mean, the movies are fun. Don't get me wrong. Sure. I have them all on DVD, but they're just not really, same characters, same story, but completely different from the books.
The one movie I'm thinking of, the new Casino Royale with, what's his face?
Daniel Craig.
That gets closest, think, to the books than the rest of the movies.
Yeah, there's definitely a depth in Craig's Bond that isn't there in even Sean Connery, who to me, Sean Connery is James Bond, but that's just because he was the first and he's, you know, the one I grew up watching as a little kid. Mm-hmm. But I don't think Sean Connery ever got James Bond to the level that Daniel Craig did.
No.
In my opinion.
And I mean, he probably could have, but that's just not what they were going for.
Right. You know? Exactly. Yep. It was the 60s and all that, you know, slick, fast paced stuff was the thing, you know.
Talking about character today, but character is related to plot. So
sure is.
You know, you, as we mentioned earlier, when you care about the character, you care more about what's happening. Because it's affecting this character that you've come to know and love. So when you have one, you have the other.
And a strong character is going to take the plot to places that a shallow character might not be able to. So they are intimately interrelated.
I think it would be really difficult to, if you had a strong character, to not have a strong plot, because the character would be making that plot strong.
Exactly.
Like there are a lot of, you know, like more literary books, you know, that you and I have read where it doesn't. Hemingway is great at this. It doesn't seem like anything's happening, but under the surface, everything is happening.
I was actually thinking about Hemingway when I was driving home because you and I had talked about what we were going to do today and we were talking about character. And I always go to Jake Barnes. I don't know why he's my favorite Hemingway character, but that book is a perfect example of, you know, you start reading it and all of a sudden you're at the end and you're like, what just happened? Right. And then, you know, you think about it a little more and it's like so much just happened.
It is probably my favorite Hemingway book.
Mm-hmm. Mine too.
I mean, even tops what everybody else knows, like, you know, For Whom the Bell Tolls and all that. I do like The Old Man and the Sea, but The Sun Also Rises. That's the ticket. So you can definitely have a character will drive plot, and you could, I suppose, have plot without character. But it would just be your basic, well, it'd be your James Bond movie without the weight of the character of James Bond in it.
Right. You know? Right. Has your email inbox been inundated with privacy practice updates lately?
You know, it's weird because it has. And I just sort of assumed it was kind of the end of the year legal cover your butt kind of thing going on.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it is, but it did bring to mind to me the fact that we have never officially given our privacy practices for good sentences.
No, we should probably get on that.
I can basically sum it up in one sentence. We will treat everyone involved with good sentences, including the listeners, as if we were all in the mafia together and nobody says nothing.
We were joking before the show and I was like, our privacy policy is one line.
Exactly.
Which, I mean, you go to most of these sites and it's like pages and pages of legalese and nobody ever reads.
And so for all we know, right in the middle of all of them, it just says the word psych, you know.
Well, I go to these, do you accept such and such policy for viewing? Yes, whatever. Because I accept.
Right.
I'm just there to.
5 minutes later, there's a knock at your door. Hi, we're here to collect all your furniture.
Like,
what are you talking about? Well, you just accepted the policy, dude. It was right in there. Didn't you read it?
I'm not obviously a lawyer. I wonder if there's some sort of protection for dumbasses. Like, you just, because, like, for example, these, you install some software, same thing. You have this big, long thing. You have to accept it to install the software. And I never just, whatever. Okay, fine. I'm fine with it.
Right.
And my computer explodes. You know, but if there's, what if there's some sort of legal protection for dummies where, hey, you said, okay, you accepted it. But then the judge is like, yeah, but he's a moron. Yeah, you can't really expect him. First of all, he can't read.
Second of all, he accepted his public execution. Do you think he really meant to do that? So anyway, that's our privacy policy. Do with it what you will, folks.
Yeah.
The other thing I wanted to talk about before we left today was, I'm sure you've seen dash cam videos, right?
Oh, yeah.
I don't have a dash cam because I drive a 2007 Toyota Corolla and I don't think it could handle the weight of the dash cam. If ever I did, today would have been a great day for it, because I saw a living meme as I was driving out of my community. There's a gentleman walking, and my first impression when I saw him was he was walking in a manner that would suggest trying to improve his health. He was swinging his arms. It looked like he was, you know, doing things that would raise his heart rate. Now, I'm not judging anyone, but this individual was probably about 5'5" and had to go at least 300, 350 pounds.
Yeah.
So obviously if he's on a journey towards health, he's at the beginning. But the thing that made it the meme for me in my mind was the fact that he had a cigarette hanging out of his mouth the whole time. So I guess he's easing into this whole health thing.
Right, exactly. You know? You don't want to start walking and then stop smoking on the same day.
No. As they said in the airplane movies, I guess I picked a bad day to stop sniffing glue. But then the other thing that made me wish I had a dash cam today was on the total opposite of the spectrum. And without going into detail, I will tell you that Craig and I had a discussion in the past day or so about seeing pictures of people and immediately hating them. And I certainly, you know, as soon as he said that to me, I'm like, oh man, have I ever, you know. But today the exact opposite happened, because I was driving into the village where I live and a guy was walking towards me. He was with, I think I didn't look at them closely enough to pin this down, but I think it was like a teen daughter or something like that. But just before I drove past them, she said something and he smiled, and his smile ate his entire face. It was such a huge smile. And I immediately liked the guy. Yeah. I mean, never see him again, but it was an instant, oh, that guy's awesome sort of thing.
I still remember, and I was just a kid at this time, but it was near Christmas time. And me and my sister and my mom and dad were out. I think we went down to Kmart when those were still around. And we were doing a last minute Christmas shopping. You know, everybody's in a bad mood. It's just busy and it's just, you couldn't get through the aisles. Well, we go out and it was dark out and slushy snow, you know, and we look behind. There is a little bit of a commotion, and we look behind and there is this dad running to their car with his daughter on his shoulders, and they were both laughing, and it was just that moment summed just up Christmas.
Right.
And I mean, that's been probably 30 years ago, and I've never forgotten it. I can still see him. I mean, so when you messaged me about that, I immediately thought of that experience, and it's just, oh man, it almost makes you happy to be alive in that moment. It's
my friends, is rare.
Yep. No, I'm okay. I'm actually glad I got up this morning after all. I didn't think I was, but now I am. And really, that's all it takes, folks. So when you get done listening to this podcast, hopefully we've made you smile. Go out and smile at somebody.
Exactly. You
know? There's one thing I like to do now and then when I'm going through a drive-thru is pay for the car behind me. Mm-hmm. I do that every now and then. It makes me feel great. And the reason I'm doing it is because somebody did it to me once. And it was such a great feeling that I wanted to pay that forward, and I got kind of addicted to it now.
And so, in a related story, I like to go through the drive-thru behind Craig.
It's funny. I have this Corolla following me everywhere I go.
Looks like a dash cam could sink it, right. But the guy's always behind me.
Went through the oil change place, and there he was. I mean, he's really trying to – he's upping the ante now. But, yeah, seriously, just go out, smile at somebody, maybe pay for the meal of the guy and gal behind you. Just pay it forward, and I'm telling you, now, not everybody will appreciate it, but 9 times out of 10, you're going to make somebody's day. Again, I remember that experience for 30 years. You might be the experience that somebody remembers for 30 years. Go out there and be that difference.